it's a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teachings, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. In February 1975, Uchiyana Roshi gave his last lecture at Antaiji before retiring as an abbot. And it was snowing that day, and 100 people listened for over 2 hours to his talk, his farewell address entitled The Way Seeker. And I would like to present that talk to you. It won't take 2 hours today in its entirety, because in it he condensed everything that he knew about practice from his whole life down to 7 points. And they're very wonderful. It's a very wonderful job that he did. So he calls it the Way Seeker, and I'm gonna skip the list. He gives a list first, and then he goes on to giving a discussion of each point. So I'll just go straight to the discussion. And unless I chime in, this is Uchiyama Roshi speaking. And on the first topic of seven, of the seven most important points of Buddhist practice, the first is study and practice the Buddha Dharma only for the sake of the Buddha Dharma, not for the sake of emotions or worldly ideas. And he says, no one emphasized practicing Buddha Dharma only for the sake of Buddha Dharma more than Dogen. And it's the essence of his teaching. But what is it really? And he says that a famous koan of a Chinese Zen master, Shito, This is Sekito Kisen, the writer of the Sandokai, which we discussed in the third series called Branching Streams Flow into Darkness. That was the Sandokai written by Sekito Kisen. And it's this Sekito Kisen featured no gaining, no knowing. That was what he featured. And he felt that was an excellent expression of Buddha Dharma. So this koan is in Dogen's Shobo Genzo. And Shito, or Sekito Kisen, was one of the great Zen masters in the flowering of Zen in China in the 8th century. And one of his disciples, Dawu, asks, what is the essential meaning of Buddha Dharma? And Shito replied, no gaining, no knowing. And Dawu asks again, can you say anything further? And Shito answers, the expansive sky does not obstruct the floating white clouds. No gaining, no knowing is an attitude of refraining from all fabrication. It means to be free from ideas that we make up in our head. That fabrication is a common Buddhist term, and that's what it means, fabricating. Uchiyama Roshi calls this opening the hand of thought. When we open the hand of thought, the things made up inside our heads fall away. That is the meaning of dropping off body and mind. You may have heard that expression. Since all our troubles are caused by our discriminating minds, we should open the hand of thought And to practice opening the hand of thought concretely with the body and mind is Zazen. And actually, now this is me chiming in, there's a story that shows how powerful this concept of no gaining, no knowing was to Uchiyama. Since Antaiji was a small temple, although they had a strict Zazen schedule, as we talked about last week, they couldn't get qualifications as teachers in the Soto school. So in order to get an official qualification to become a temple priest, they had to go to a different temple. And so they went to Uchiyama Roshi, his students, and they said, you know, what can we, we're doing all this work and we can't get qualified. And he said, the practice at Antaiji has no bait. They needed to just practice for the sake of practice without any expectation of desirable results. So as you can see in Uchiyama's teachings, this practice without any expectation was very important when his disciples, who undoubtedly practiced more Zazen than anyone else, they couldn't get credentialed or acknowledged by outside standards as priests. And he just simply said, we practice for the sake of practice and don't expect anything to come from it. So that was how strictly he held that, this particular first point. So back to what he's saying, we can also say that Buddha Dharma is the Dharma realized by a Buddha. The word Buddha means one who has awakened. So Buddha Dharma means what awareness is, or perhaps the way of awareness. And what is the way of awareness? The essential point in Zazen is to be vividly aware, opening the hand of thought, because thoughts themselves are the source of illusion. Buddhism emphasizes two principles of life, impermanence, and that all phenomena are the results of causes and conditions and are without permanent or independent substance. So I, Gail, basically don't exist. As in the way that it looks like I exist as a permanent person here in the world, endlessly speaking. The only true enlightenment is awareness of the vivid reality of life moment by moment. So we practice enlightenment right now, right here in every moment. Practice and enlightenment are one. And this is how, for a long time, I didn't understand that, but it's enlightenment is not a thing. It's not a fixed thing that you get. It's a dynamic. It's a dynamic that happens in conjunction with practice and opening the hand of thought. Enlightenment is nothing but awakening from illusions and returning to the reality of life, which Shakyamuni Buddha called precepts or emancipation through the observance of the precepts, which means if we uphold a certain precept, we will be emancipated to the extent of that precept. And he quotes from Shakyamuni Buddha, monks, after my death, respect and follow the pratimokcha, which means precepts. If you do, you will be like a person who has been given a light in the dark, or like a pauper who acquires a great treasure. These are Shakyamuni's last words. And Uchiyama says, I think the idea of pratimokcha is the origin of Dogen's practice and enlightenment are one. Life and death do not take place in our heads, in the illusions we fabricated throughout our lives. They occur beyond human thought. They occur where the hand of thought is open. To practice opening the hand of thought right here, right now, knowing that the reality of life is beyond human thought, that is what it means to practice Buddha Dharma only for the sake of Buddha Dharma. Opening the hand of thought is itself practicing Buddha Dharma only for the sake of Buddha Dharma. We should respect the Buddha Dharma by letting go of thoughts as being the most valuable thing we can do. But that is letting go of thoughts. The basis of Buddha Dharma is the expansive sky does not obstruct the floating white clouds. We must neither oppose nor deny the existence of human emotions and worldly ideas. We don't justify practicing Buddha Dharma by human emotions and worldly ideas. It is not a standard for judging people. The most important point in Buddhism is that each of us practices it ourselves. We must apply every teaching and every practice to ourselves. In understanding Buddha Dharma for the sake of Buddha Dharma, this attitude is essential. So he felt very strongly about this point. And it's not made so directly that often. And so I'm happy to be the one passing this on to you. And that's his first point. Practice the Buddha Dharma only for the sake of the Buddha Dharma. And then the second point is Zazen is our truest and most venerable teacher. Dogen Zenji said, if you cannot find a true teacher, it is better not to practice. That's so like Dogen to say that. But Zazen is our only true teacher. This is an important point. I have never said to my disciples, this is Uchiyama, that I am a true teacher. From the beginning, I have said that Zazen, each of us, the Zazen each of us practices is the only true teacher. Please do not forget that the Zazen of opening the hand of thought is what constitutes our true teacher and is most worthy of respect. So that's his second point. And I just want to say that opening the hand of thought is just what it sounds like. When you're doing Zazen and your mind is rattling off, which minds do, so there's no problem. We open the hand of thought and we just go back to our sitting practice. And then it happens again and you do the same thing again. Go back to your sitting practice. Our Zazen is not about how many times we have to pull ourselves out of a thought. The human mind is like, in Buddhism it's thought, the human mind is like the secretor of thoughts. That's what it does. So we don't attach to them. We just stop them and return. And not to judge. There's no judgment around that. That's what we do. That's what Zazen is. So long as you return. Okay, and then his third of seven points is Zazen must work concretely in our daily lives as the two practices, vow and repentance. The three minds, magnanimous mind, nurturing mind, and joyful mind, and as the realization of the saying, gaining is delusion, losing is enlightenment. Writing and teaching to clarify just what true Zazen is has been my most important work for many years, Uchiyama is saying. To recognize true Zazen, we have to look at our practice from an absolute perspective. Buddhism teaches impermanence and the quality of non-ego, that we are without a permanent substance. Instead of trying to satisfy our desires, in Buddhism, just the opposite is true. It is important for us to have to leave our desires alone without trying to fulfill them. If we push this one step further, gaining is delusion, losing is enlightenment, we're talking about active participation in loss. But not to turn even this into some kind of gaining. So that's easy to do. See how great I am. So not to do that. For breaking the ego's grip, nothing is more effective than giving something up. This is Uchiyama. And he continues, I have been practicing Zazen for some 30 years since becoming a monk. And the one thing that is gradually becoming clearer to me is that I am one with everything, completely beyond considerations of usefulness. Zazen is good for nothing, but the longer I practice, the clearer it becomes to me that nothing is separated from me. I am connected to everything. Where do we go after death? Nowhere. Life is universal. When we're born, we come from this universal life. We are all, without exception, universal. Only our brains get caught up in the notion that we are individual and in the notion of life and death. Where are we going after death? Back to universal life. That's why the Japanese refer to the recently deceased as, quote, one who has returned to the origin. Thinking is also one of the functions of the universal self. But our brains can think of things that do not exist. We can think about yesterday and tomorrow, neither of which exist. No matter what we think about, we cannot be separated from the original self. Likewise, we cannot be separated from our individual personal self either, which has the karma to produce all kinds of delusion. The human condition involves existing in the midst of this relationship between personal and universal self. In our life as personal self, universal self is not something to yearn for. It's a direction toward which we should aim. That is the meaning of vow. The first of the four bodhisattva vows is sentient beings are innumerable. I vow to free them all. This means to settle as universal life, wherever that life naturally settles. The second vow is cravings are inexhaustible. I vow to extinguish them all. This means refraining from being dragged around by one's thoughts. But as long as we are human beings, we're going to have a mind that fabricates thoughts. So we have to continuously study the Buddha Dharma to clarify the reality of ourself. This is the meaning of the third vow. Dharma teachings are limitless. I vow to learn them all. And the fourth vow is the Buddha way is endless. I vow to complete it or realize it. With this, we vow to settle as the universal self. So all of them really, we're settling as the universal self. But that is not separate from the personal self. A classic Mahayana text says, the true mind of every sentient being itself teaches and leads each sentient being. This is the vow of Buddha. So vow is not a special speculative approach to something outside ourselves. The true mind of sentient beings, that is the universal self, itself is vow. Thus, when we consider universal self from the vantage point of personal self, we realize that we cannot live without vow. And as you know, the purpose of this series is for everyone to create their own personal vow. then on the other hand, when we consider personal self from the ground of universal self, we realize that we are not what we should be. We cannot actualize universal self because we are restrained by the handcuffs and fetters of karma. In this frame of mind, we can't help but repent. In the very nature of the relationship between universal self and personal self, vow and repentance naturally emerge. It is a mistake to consider it only from one perspective. So Uchiyama is saying you must grasp this: one zazen, two practices, three minds. He says, I made it up. The three minds describe the way as individual personal selves we should function to reveal our original universal self. So we just have these joyful mind, magnanimous mind, and parental mind. And to just, if you just stay with that and use that as criteria for assessing how you're doing each minute, you'll be good to go. In Buddhism, big refers to something beyond comparison and differentiation. This is revealed when we open the hand of our thinking that discriminates between things. When we entirely let go of thought, magnanimous mind is there. Then we encounter everything as the all-inclusive self that is one with the 10 directions. Wherever I find myself, I just live out the self that is nothing but the self in my own way. And this is magnanimous mind. As a natural outgrowth of the attitude that whatever I encounter is nothing but myself, I take great care of my life, he says. This is the approach toward everything that is called nurturing mind. Many people are adults only physically. Spiritually, they are still children. When childish people get married, it is only natural that they will have problems because they expect others to take care of them. But conjugal love requires each to think of the other first. Each has to take care of the other. In Buddhism, this attitude is applied to the whole world. The Lotus Sutra says, in this triple world, all is my domain. The living beings in it are all my children. This mind that sympathizes with everything, that penetrates into everything, not for itself, but for others. This is the joyful mind. As a natural extension, we need to find the real meaning of our life in taking care of others and in putting our life spirit into that attitude and effort. The life spirit that meets everything with a nurturing mind is joyful mind. So he's actually bringing them all together. So to kind of tie up this one, he creates a formula called a complete life formula. So notice what he says is a complete life formula. We who are committed to a life of zazen must maintain the two practices of vow and repentance and the three minds that we just went over in our zazen, an attitude of feeling safe and at peace as long as one is sitting is no good at all. All sentient beings are crying out in one form or another. They are suffering and in distress, as we well know. We have to foster the vow deep in our hearts that we will work to settle all sentient beings. Vow is fundamental to our practice. Even though we take this vow, it is difficult to carry it out. So we have to acknowledge this about ourselves and with a repentant heart. then we have to actualize our vow through functioning the three minds. So do you see how he's, this is the end of that point, the third point. And do you see how he weaves in those three minds to everything? So the one mind of Zazen practice and the two minds of vow and repentance, and then the three minds are how we do everything. They're just how we do everything. And I think it's a really wonderful standard, magnanimous, joyful, and nurturing to all beings, especially yourself. The fourth point is live by vow and root it deeply. Root it deeply. Here is the section of the essay on protecting and maintaining practice in Dogen Sobogenzo. I still said that wrong. Sobogenzo. On Bodhidharma, which describes the purest and most concrete form of vow. This is Dogen now. The first ancestor in China came from the West as directed by Master Prajnatara. It took him 3 years to reach China by sea. He surely experienced innumerable hardships, including storms and blizzards, and faced great danger sailing on the wide ocean. Despite those difficulties, he managed to arrive in an unknown country. Ordinary people who hold their lives dear can't even imagine doing such a thing. I just want to say, I'm sure it was in Dogen's mind when he himself traveled to China the same way, but from Japan, not as far as from India, but still, actually, he did the same thing, only a slightly shorter version. Then Dogen continues, this way of protecting and maintaining practice stemmed from his great compassion and his vow to transmit the Dharma and save deluded living beings. His vow, meaning Bodhidharma's. He was able to do it. He, Bodhidharma, was able to do it because he himself was the Dharma self of transmission. So basically transmission was his practice. So Bodhidharma's practice was transmission. And that was so powerful in him that he traveled by sea from India to China to transmit the Dharma to people who did not yet have it. So he was able to do it himself because he himself was the Dharma self of transmission. And for him, the whole universe was the world of transmitting Dharma, the whole universe. One of the Buddha's 10 principal disciples, by the way, this is Mina, saying, was foremost in transmitting the Dharma and insisted on doing it in a very wild and dangerous land. And when he told the Buddha, you know, I'm going to such and such, I can't remember the place. And the Buddha went, no, it's way too dangerous there. You shouldn't go. And why do you have to go to such a dangerous place? You can teach the Dharma, you know, right next door. And I can't remember the foremost disciple in transmitting the Dharma was to Shakyamuni Buddha, but he nevertheless, despite the Buddha's horror at the whole thing, traveled to this dangerous land and did succeed in establishing the Dharma there. It's amazing. Wherever you are living is a palace. This is Dogen still. Wherever you are living is a palace, and there is no palace that is not an appropriate place to practice the way. This is why Bodhidharma came from the West the way he did. He had neither doubt nor fear because he was living in the world of saving deluded beings, the world of vow. So that's the end of Uchiyama Roshi quoting Dogen. And then Uchiyama tells the story of becoming a monk, and then his life, he was saying, was so wretched, I felt as if I were being trampled over and over again, the way we stamp on weeds. And I was never able to put forth even the tiniest bud. Uchiyama Roshi now is talking about his own very difficult life becoming a monk. When things were tough, I chose to stick with my vow and bury it deeply in the earth to take root there. If I hadn't done that, that vow would have died because I was always being trampled. The more I was beaten down, the deeper I rooted my vow to create the next generation. I think it was the same for Bodhidharma. He made the huge effort to make the risky journey all the way from India to China, where he met Emperor Wu of Liang. The emperor couldn't understand the Indian monk, so Bodhidharma went to Mount Shaolin. In short, he was scorned. Still, he had vowed to transmit the Dharma and save living beings. And because of that vow, he was able to live out his life. And while he was practicing Zazen quietly at Mount Shaolin, he rooted the vow in the ground. And don't forget, Bodhidharma is the one who sat facing a wall for 9 years. So at Shaolin, he did Zazen for 9 years. And finally, Uchiyama Roshi is relating the story, and he says, then Huike became his disciple. Huike became Bodhidharma's disciple. So Bodhidharma was the first Chinese ancestor, so Huike would be the second Chinese ancestor. He too was trampled down his whole life, even after he became a disciple of Bodhidharma and practiced Zazen. Through the times of the third, fourth, and fifth patriarchs, they all had a hard time, but they rooted themselves in their vows. And by the time of the sixth patriarch, finally, Zen started to ripen. So Uchiyama is saying, you have to expect to be trampled on by different difficult circumstances, maybe even for many years. But don't lose your life force under all the pressure. Unless you have that vow, you will lose heart. Only when you live by vow does everything you meet, wherever, whenever, whatever happens, reinforce your life as Buddha Dharma. As long as you have that vow to live out your life wherever you are, sooner or later, spring will come. And when it does, you will have the strength to grow. This is the life force. You have to thoroughly understand that this is completely different from selfish ambition. This is really an important point. This is not, I have this goal and I'm going to do anything I can to reach it. It's, I am going to practice no matter what, and I'm going to continue to practice the Buddha Dharma no matter what. And each and every day, I sit Zazen for the length of time that I've told myself I'll sit Zazen, and so forth. It's that's what it means by rooting your vow. Rooting your vow is just, it's almost like retaking your vow just to yourself. And each day you retake your own vow, sort of like people who get married and then 5 years later, they retake their marriage vows. Couples do this a lot. They'll, even 25 years later, they'll retake their marriage vows. All right, and so now we're on number 5, realizing that development and backsliding are your responsibility alone. endeavor to practice and develop. And then he says, there's a saying in Dogen's Instructions for the Cook, a foolish person regards himself as another. A wise man regards others as himself. And Uchiyama says, actually, there's no such thing as other people. Other people are also yourself. So a wise man regards other people as himself. To live out your life as that self that is one with everything means that when you encounter other people, you should live out your life yourself in that very meeting between you and them. You have the attitude of putting yourself in another's shoes. Furthermore, you have to live out yourself as your own responsibility. Ultimately, developing and backsliding depend only on you. A lot of people, well, actually, this happened to Uchiyama Roshi. He ordained one of his monks as a priest, and there was an ordination ceremony. And then the next day, he called that priest to him, and he said, you know, last night after the ceremony, your father came to me and said, please take care of my son. And I want you to know that I can't do that. You need to take care. You need to be responsible for yourself. I can't be responsible for you, but you can walk in the same direction as I walk. So you can look at me and see the direction that I'm faced, which is toward Buddha. And you can walk in the same direction that I'm walking so that we're both facing toward Buddha. That's what he's saying. But you're responsible for yourself. And this is actually a really interesting model for a monastery. It's really interesting. It's very different from the model I came from at Zen Center, where basically the Roshi, who had Doksan with each and every student alone during Sesshin, so that he didn't sit Sesshin with us. In this model, the Roshi just sits as Sheen, just like everybody else, and there is no calling anyone out. You just sit. And the way I practiced, you know, the Roshi was hardly ever in the Zendo, and you always wondered kind of, where is he? And you knew he was giving Doksan, but there was something funny about it. Like he's not where he belongs. There was often that feeling. He's not where he belongs. That was not the case with Suzuki Roshi, but just with Baker Roshi. And in this model, there is no idea of the Roshi being in charge of your practice or directing your practice. You're directing your practice looking in the same direction as your teacher. And that's how it is. I think there's a lot of wisdom in this model. So the fundamental attitude of a practitioner must be to live out his own whole self. It also could be her own whole self, by the way, or their own whole self. Point six. Sit silently for 10 years, then for 10 more years, and then for another 10 years. And he explains this by saying, one inch sitting, one inch Buddha, means that one inch is altogether Buddha. So we should resolve to sit as much as possible. So every inch we sit, that's how much Buddha we have, he's saying. We have to live out ourselves, understanding that everything depends on ourselves. We have to practice long enough to realize this attitude, sitting silently for at least 10 years. One inch sitting for just a short time, is good zazen, since there is no specific amount of time that we can say we should sit. So I want you to hear this. I'm going to repeat that sentence. One inch sitting for just a short time is also good zazen, since there is no specific amount of time that we can say we should sit. But the more we practice opening the hand of thought, the clearer it becomes to us that self is not the same as thought. We come to see decisively that the true self is not something made up in our heads. True self is the self of everything, the self of the whole Dharma world, the original self that is manifest when we let go of thought. In other words, if we practice for a long time, there will really be some result that we'll know ourselves, really, we'll know our real selves. Even if we sit for only a short time, that is all right. There is no question that we become aware of reality in our sitting, but we have to keep practicing our whole lives to be aware of our true universal self. We should continue to practice as long as we live. There is a chapter in the Shobo Genzo entitled Refraining from All Evil. And in a passage in it says, when all evil truly comes not to be produced, the power of practice is completely actualized. This actualization embraces the whole earth, the whole world, all time, the whole Dharma. The measure of its actualization can be found in the depth of refraining from evil. Instead of just trying to avoid doing something evil by means of moral effort, we can actualize the universal self of the whole earth, the whole world, and the whole Dharma. When we settle in the universal self, all evil is necessarily not produced. So this is an argument, by the way, of sitting zazen as a way to help relieve the world from suffering. The measure of its actualization can be found in the depth of refraining from evil, means that when we keep on practicing zazen steadily, we will understand deeply that whenever, wherever, whatever happens, everything is universal. It is in that manner that all evil comes not to be produced. That's why we have to practice as long as we live. What you do with your life depends on you. With that understanding, what you do with your life depends on you. Just sit silently for 10 years, then for another 10 years, and after that, for 10 more years. And finally, his last seventh point is cooperate with one another and aim to create a place where sincere practitioners can practice without trouble. He's talking really about a monastery, but monasteries are really just little universes, little contained universes, but a monastery can be two people also. A place of practice is as important to the practitioner as soil is to the farmer. To be practicing and to get caught up in sexual affairs, money or fame, or even to be blinded by your own practice is a terrible waste of time. It is important that every one of us cooperate with each other to protect and maintain an atmosphere conducive to practicing together. There is no one who can claim to always embody Bodhi mind, the mind that aspires to practice and attain enlightenment. Each of us gathers and contributes his or her own little Bodhi mind to the general effort. Sawaki Roshi often said that a monastery is like a charcoal file in a hibachi. If you put in just a little one coal, it will go out right away. But if you gather many small coals, each glowing just a little bit, the fire will flare up. In the same way, every one of us should contribute a little Bodhi mind and thus enable our Sangha to thrive. And he wrote a poem called Leaving Antaiji. So this is this, by the way, so this talk that I just gave you, The Way Seeker, is the last talk he gave and when he retired from being an abbot and left his monastery, Antaiji. And then he has this poem, Leaving Antaiji. As an old man, I have my own practice. It is different from that of youth. It is not facing outward, but just facing inward, gazing at myself. And like the clouds that disappear into the expansive sky, I too will disappear quietly. And he continues, lately I, Uchiyama Roshi, have fully realized that when we open the hand of thought, we are the self of the whole Dharma world, whether we think so or not. Do you understand this self of the whole Dharma world? Everything is one with everything. Practicing sincerely. I will lie there sorrowing if you live, and he's saying as if his final two sentences, I will lie there sorrowing if you live blindly. Please let me lie cheerfully in the shadow of the grass. I ask this of you wholeheartedly. I realized this was a lot. And instead of creating new reflection questions for the week, I've listed again the 7 points that Uchiyama Roshi, when thinking over his entire life as a Buddhist practitioner, chose as the 7 most important points for practice. And so I encourage you to review them, just the points, not the commentary. On the website, they're listed under points for reflection during the week. I can't guarantee that I'll be able to answer your questions, since this was his teaching. But I thought it was so profound and so special to find a teacher who will rethink his entire life and pick out 7 important points that I wanted to pass them on to you. But if you have any questions, please ask.
Thank you, Gail. We have a question. The question is, why do they say Zazen is good for nothing when it is good for seeing reality and the universal self and enabling the practice of Buddhism?
Because even that cannot be a goal. Even that is not something that we strive for, and then when we reach it, that's the end. And Buddha himself, Shakyamuni Buddha, is a perfect example of he attained enlightenment when he was, I forget the number, 30 something, 33 maybe. And then he practiced, then he, from there, he taught for like 40 years. So even attaining enlightenment was not the end. There is no end. Practice is considered endless. So we are always, and that was kind of the gist of when Uchiyama Roshi says, practice for 10 years and then practice for another 10 years and then go ahead and practice another 10 years. There's no place to stop practicing because we practice for the sake of practice. And each and every day, we just do our very best. And there's no judgment, and there's no, all I did was think today, so that was useless. There's none of that. It's just, I did my best. That's all. Now I'm going to do my best at something else. So the short answer to your question is, it's good for nothing because there's no place where we achieve a thing. there's always what to do to continue to practice. And Dogen called practice one continuous mistake that we human beings, constantly, day after day, we make one mistake after another. And if you've paid attention, you'll probably know that that's true. And so that our life really boils down to one continuous mistake, and then we just keep going on making more mistakes endlessly. And then we die. And we don't actually die. We enter universal life. We enter universal life and we re-enter universal life. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is, what is the best way to change our habits of behavior and thought?
You know, there's an Alexander teacher who has studied this question of habits. And she says that trying to use inhibition or restraint, what happens is that we use restraint, but the brain resets to its old current default. So we try and keep ourselves from doing our bad habit, but the brain resets itself to our old current default. So the default is your old habit. So using restraint does nothing, basically. You have to reset the subcortical level of the brain in order to change a habit. And to reset the subcortical level, you have to think through each and every step that's required in the new pattern. So you think through step one, step two, and you've done that for that day. And probably the brain is going to reset to its old default, which is your old habit. So you have to do that each and every day. And I have found, I used to say that 3 months minimum, because I tried this and I wasn't successful until after 3 months of every single day. But she says that some defaults are easier to reset than others. So apparently it depends on what default you're resetting. But just know that when you use your willpower to refrain from all evil, the only thing that happens in your brain is it resets to the last default, which is your habit. So you will accomplish nothing. You need to reset the subcortical levels. And the way to do that is to rethink each and every step of your new habit, what you want to lay down now. And depending on how easy or hard that particular habit reset is, you'll be successful in laying down a new habit. I'm sorry, it's really hard. It's really hard. The best thing is don't lay down bad habits, but we all do. So it's really hard. It's really hard. She says that this is like beginner's mind. And it's like you just every single time you have to go there and do all the thinking all over again. So I think is there another question? If it's short.
Yeah, there's one more question. And the question is, I'm not quite grasping the expression, the hand of thought. Can you clarify that?
Yes. It's just, don't try to take it literally. It's like when you open your hand, this is his most famous phrase, opening the hand of thought. And if you just say Uchiyama Roshi to somebody, oh, he's the one who said opening the hand of thought. That's how close they are. And the way to use that is just think of opening your hand. It's like a gesture of opening your hand. And when you open your hand like that, everything spills out. So if you open your hand of thought, all your thoughts spill out. So there you are thinking in Zazen and you go, oh, I'm thinking. You just open your hand. And it's a kind of, what is the word for this, Winnie? You embody a kind of way. It's a kind of way to embodying getting rid of thoughts. You just let the spigot open. And he just invented, he made it up. And it's actually, I find it very effective. You know, just open your hand and don't try to overthink it. Just open your hand and everything spills out. And that's that set of thoughts. And then you're back to your Zazen. Same thing happens. Open your hand of thought. It's convenient and it's useful. But if it isn't useful for you, then don't do it. But it doesn't make any sense, but it kind of makes a physical sense. That's all. Well, all right. Thank you for being here and listening to this presentation called The Way Seeker by Uchiyama Roshi. And I want to thank the people who have made it possible to be here, yourselves and Brendan and Brian and Sahar. And I hope to see you next week. Bye-bye.